You are invited to join us at WGN Radio Walk of Fame. This year, we're recognizing seven honorees. The induction ceremony on Friday at 10 a.m. outside Tribune Tower on Pioneer Court. Bring a chair. Enjoy the celebration commemorating Max Armstrong, Floyd Brown, Jim Carollo, Dan Fabian, Marilyn Miller, Tom Peterson, and Dean Richards. That day, you can also follow our live blog online at WGNRadio.com. Visit WGNRadio.com/Walk of Fame for details. We'll be there.
We definitely will be.
All right. True American hero, Colonel Tony Dean is joining us. And Colonel, thank you very much for being with us. He's got a book out coming out next week called Ramadi Declassified, A Roadmap to Peace in the Most Dangerous City in Iraq. And though this is a book specifically about what is happening in Anbar province and a little bit of, you know, how we got there and why it's so important, I think there is some really broad implications here for the entire war on terror. And it seems to me, Colonel, that as Ramadi has been going back and forth, right, between ISIS forces and you can't really call them coalition forces anymore, can you? They're more Iraqi national forces.
Yeah, exactly. When we arrived in the summer of 2006, it was under al-Qaeda and Iraq control. And over the course of the summer and the through the fall and the following months, we were able to take back the city by some aggressive, just heroic fighting on the part of all the soldiers and Marines that were there. And two, we reached out to the locals and we said, hey, you got to help us here. And help us help you. And we got the tribal leaders on board. And together, we rid the town of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Following that was the surge. And then everything just got a lot better. And, and then again, in about 2 years ago, it fell again to ISIS forces, who were really just the latest incarnation of the al-Qaeda in Iraq guys.
Well, okay. Now let's talk about that, because I think this is something that people misunderstand. I know that we're going to get a little bit into the detail of what's happened here, but I think it's very instructive. When the Ba'athist Party fell, Saddam Hussein's people fell in Iraq, they were a very small group of people. It was a very specific religious organization. They came from a specific religious strain that really is not a majority or even the largest minority in all of what was Iraq, right? You had the Sunnis to the north and the Shias to the south and the east, you know, that bordered the Iranian border. And in Iraq, the actual borders of Iraq, as we understood it, you know, were 20th century inventions. And this had been all tribal regions and sectarian regions with people fighting with each other. Now, all of a sudden, you know, you got Saddam Hussein leading with an iron fist, becomes a predator in his own backyard to, you know, some of the people around him. He was fomenting acts of terror in other parts of the Middle East and, you know, just a bully and a bad guy and all those things. And we decided we were going to get involved in this. And, you know, however we want to couch that or further define it, you know, there are a lot of theories as to why we did it, but we did it. And when we did it, it left a vacuum because he, through his brutality, was able to keep relative, and this is a term, relative peace. There was still a ton of violence, but, you know, they were basically pillaging and raping the country, but they're at least keeping the Shia and the Sunni from killing each other. Well, then those all fall and his army melts, his army leadership melts, right? And then they become the technical war advisors for for the crazies.
Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, we also kind of played a hand in that a little bit with the de-basification policies and disbanding the army. And that's what we found, like I said, when I arrived, was a lot of these Sunnis who, you know, for 20% minority of the country controlled, you know, 90% of the power in the country. These people are all of a sudden, you know, they're disenfranchised. They see the government that was installed in Baghdad as a tool of the Shia and the Iranians. And so it was on. And it wasn't really until about 2006 that we got a hold on it. And one of the things that happened was we had this sheikh that was working with us named Sitar Abarishu, who was a really colorful character, carried a chrome 45, chrome plated 45, six shooter, very charismatic, and he got the rest of the tribal leaders on board. And through that, and then the surge later on, there was actually, you know, a pretty good little chance at peace there. And you know, they were working together as a government. But then after the pullout in 2011, the Americans really were seen as the honest brokers. And all those gains kind of got flushed away after that. And, you know, it started again as soon as we left the Maliki government. The prime minister there started throwing all the Sunnis out of the army. And he sent the Iraqi army into Anbar province, and that's when Fallujah fell again. And I think it was 2012, in January 2012.
Mm-hmm. Colonel, you were talking about the successful campaign to root out ISIS in Ramadi. I saw a report on ABC News about they went back and visited Ramadi, and they showed what a ghost town it has become, though, and what the destruction, the unexploded mines, the people, the civilians who used to be there afraid to come back. There's nothing there for them to come back to. And they're talking about how Fallujah now, where, you know, there's efforts to root out ISIS there from controlling that city, that it must not become the same thing, that the civilians must be allowed safe passage, they don't have access to food and medical supplies, and that their infrastructure should somehow be preserved. Is that something you can do when you're rooting out hundreds of members of ISIS?
Well, that was something that we were able to do. We had a large American force on the ground, and we also had, over time, the locals got behind us, and they were able to point them out. I mean, the problem with Fallujah is the people there don't see the government in Baghdad as representative of them, so they're kind of stuck between the choice of throwing in with the terrorists. The ISIS guys are thrown in with the government they think's out to get them. So they went with the devil they knew. And you're right, Ramadi's in shambles. And, you know, I don't see a much better outcome for Fallujah between the Iraqi army tactics and the, you know, the ISIS leaving bombs behind so no one can live there.
Right. And that's one of the other pieces there, too, right, is that there are so many arms behind. And you've got these private contractors that have been called in to try to clear all of these IEDs and other kinds of basically booby traps that have been set all in the perimeters and also in these towns and in the rubble of these towns. And it's a really, 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 you know, it's hell. Could you describe it as anything other than that?
No, I can't. And the one thing that, and you kind of talked about this a couple minutes ago, was the biggest victim of this Al-Qaeda, ISIS, violence has been the Sunni people. I mean, when we were there, there was a huge murder and intimidation program being put forth by the terrorists where, you know, hey, you come along with us or we're going to, you know, beat you up or shoot you or, you know, kill you or, you know, kill your whole family. And, you know, these terrorists rule by intimidation. And it's, you know, it's a very effective tool. I hate to say it, but, you know, unless you're there to protect the people, they don't have a lot of choices.
Now, moving forward here, as you look at this, the caliphate and this ISIS insurgency in Syria, in Iraq, perhaps it moves south into Lebanon or to, God forbid, Jordan, or even the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, North Africa, the places where it's going to be. What do you think is the best strategy? I mean, you've been there, you've seen all of this. What do you think is the best strategy to stem that tide?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One, it's a realization that it really is a threat, right? And that's the one thing that we've kind of gotten away from. And, you know, ISIS is in 43 different groups pledging allegiance to ISIS in, I think, in 28 different countries. And so, at some point, you know, you've got to go and address this. The second part is, you know, getting the people to reject it. And part of it, a lot of it comes from, you know, giving them a government that they think is representative of them.
Well, right. But do they know yet? I mean, a lot of these people are only inculcated and educated in a system that isn't asking for a government other than one through Sharia law.
Yeah, I personally didn't see that. I mean, most of the guys that I dealt with, the tribal leaders, they were all pretty excited about democracy. and they didn't understand it completely. And, you know, Sheikh Sattar always used to ask me, you know, I just had the blue. He'd say, so when you're president, if he loses the election, he just leaves, correct? Yes, Sattar, and kind of, you know, shake his head. So they didn't really understand it, but they were very happy to, you know, have a chance at having some voice in their own future, something they didn't have under Saddam either. And so the Sharia law, I mean, most of them, I think they're people like everyone else. They just want to get on with their lives, you know, be free of, you know, a better chance to make money for themselves and a better life for their kids. And the very few zealots that were really, you know, true believers, there's not that many of them.
But they're obviously very influential. Right, very quickly, before we let you go, today the White House is confirming that the Taliban leader has been killed in a drone strike. I know we're changing venues here to Afghanistan, but what is your thought on that?
Well, I mean, that's good that we're serious about attacking the Taliban. But, you know, killing off a number one or a number two man, we've been doing that now for, you know, 10, 15 years. And, you know, someone will step up to take his place. So, well, that's it's good. Anytime a terrorist leader gets killed, but as I say, you got to recognize that someone's going to step up and take his place. You know, just like Al-Zahiri was killed in 2006. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now, 5 years later, al-Baghdadi takes over the organization and calls it ISIS, and we're in the mess we're in now.
Well, what ultimately will prove to be effective then, if it's not killing their leaders, what will work in ultimately destroying ISIS?
Well, I think, you know, giving the people the opportunity to get rid of them. I mean, that, we were in a very similar situation in 2006, but the people, they didn't have a way to reject the terrorists until we actually pushed out, moved in their neighborhoods, and secured them. And, you know, the Americans really were seen as the honest brokers, you know, after 2006, 2007. We were seen as the honest brokers over there. And I hate to say it, but I think, you know, some sort of presence in Iraq, and I think it'll spread from there to, you know, just calm things down. But it's going to take a political solution more than just, you know, killing terrorist leaders.
Colonel, thank you very much. Appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you, Colonel.
The book is Ramadi Declassified, A Roadmap to Peace in the Most Dangerous City in Iraq. And it's ColonelTonyDean.com. It's ColTonyDean, DEANE.com for his website. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right.